My name is Lou Smith. I will function as the moderator for this session. What that means is I count it as my chore to make sure that everybody who wants to get a word in gets a word in. Let me just say a word about priorities. I will always try to take a first speaker in this as a priority, unless we're really dealing with some kind of a coherent topic and the speaker is going to lead us off that particular subtopic and we haven't gotten to. So, sounds fair to me. If you want to speak, it's a lot easier if you'll just put your hand up. I'll try to keep my eyes roaming and spot you and identify you and let you know where you stand in the process. The topic for tonight is the dream of an inclusive church. For our kickoff people, to sort of stimulate you, although the conversation is intended to be primarily yours, we originally intended to have Magali Rodriguez, who is in the
Rodriguez Mossman,
thank you, who's in the ALC National Office in Church and Society, something like that. Okay. And Will Hertzfeld, who is on the Commission of 70 dealing with the new church. You can see that Will is not here. That's because he's part of the Holden board and they put in an extra session and they are meeting now, and so he was taken away from us. So in any event, with that introduction, Magali will kick us off with her vision, her dream for an inclusive church. And then the floor will belong to you. So, go get it.
For those of you for whom this is the third time around with this voice, I apologize. It won't happen again. This is the last time it goes like this. The rest of the week is very much clearer. I'd like to just throw up a few things. And one of them is the definition of an inclusive community, a racial and gender inclusive community. I've not gone back and made it an inclusive community, period, of all excluded groups yet. But I'd like to have you close your eyes for a minute. And I'm going to read you first the definition of racism and sexism that Bob Terry developed back in 1977, and then the definition of inclusive community that I took and when I reversed what Bob was saying about racism and sexism. Racism and sexism exist when any one racial gender group intentionally or unintentionally inequitably distributes resources, refuses to share power, maintains unresponsive and inflexible institutional policies, procedures, and practices, imposes a racial or gender-centric culture on any other racial or gender group for its supposed benefit, and justifies its actions by punishing, blaming, ignoring, and or helping the other racial or gender group. Note the helping. Definition now of racial gender inclusive community. Racial gender inclusive community exists when the pluralistic society intentionally, equitably distributes resources, shares power, maintains responsive, flexible institutions, policies, procedures, and practices, and promotes a pluralistic culture that is healthy for all racial and gender groups, for the benefit of all, and supports its actions by rewarding, encouraging, paying attention to, and otherwise stimulating information, feelings, and behaviors that sustain an effective, pluralistic, gender, racial gender inclusive community. Inclusiveness isn't just representation. That is one piece. And to define inclusiveness in another way, I've put together a document that has 8 points on it. And I'd just like to briefly go over that and do something a little more creative in a minute. First, in an inclusive society, representation is pluralistic. No one group dominates, but rather all groups are represented in some appropriate, effective way. Underrepresentation in a committee or a board or in a group is 40% or under of excluded. And that would include race, people of color, women, people who are in some way disabled, the young, the old, and so on. It's all those groups together. Participation. In order to get some sort of handle on inclusiveness, is not just putting someone or putting a group of people in a body, some sort of policy-making body or any sort of a group, but there also has to be airtime. And so to get a sense of the quality of airtime, I've put a number on it, which is very hard to do, but 40% of airtime of traditionally excluded groups. If, for example, a board consists of 5 women and 10 men, and the men are the only ones who have airtime, or who dominate 80 or 90% of the airtime, that's not inclusive. That's inclusive only in representation. There has to also be then participation. The third element is content. Again, 40% of content that is relevant to, interesting to, the excluded groups, the traditionally excluded groups. If there is at least that, then we can call it, we're getting close to real inclusiveness. So that's the third element. The fourth element is process. We've gotten very good at catching ourselves in terms of verbal racism and sexism and so on. We're getting better anyway at that. But we're still very, very unaware of process racism and sexism and ageism and elitism and all that sort of thing. And what I mean by that is the very way we do things tends to favor the included groups. If we use only the rational linear logical, that favors the rational linear logical people. And that tends to be a small portion of our society, but they're very organized. And so all power goes to them. For example, one of the big issues for people of color is what alternatives are there for congregations and church bodies for Robert's Rules of Order. Robert's Rules of Order is a control mechanism that certain very cognitive people know how to use very well, but it doesn't work in terms of it doesn't serve other people who are not of that makeup, who don't function that way. So what alternatives are there? If we want to be inclusive, sometimes we'll use Roberts and sometimes we'll use something else. You know, is there no other? I've not yet seen an alternative, but hopefully we'll think about things like that and we'll think about alternatives and other ways of doing things. Resources. If the group tends to share resources pretty much equitably, I've got a chart here of what I see organizations basically doing. There is this vault, and I put the dollar sign on it because a lot of the resources that we have are dollar resources, but there are also other kinds of resources. And in the church, we basically do this, and with no judgment, no blame on this, but this is basically, as a person, as an outsider, as a part of the excluded, even though I work at a national office, I still see that there are the guardians of the vault. Even though, for example, a group of women will raise the money for the church, the guardians of the vault, who are not women, will determine how the money gets used. The resources are geared toward basically a very small portion of the church. An example, and it's again a non-judgmental example. In the church we have all these official documents. The documents are geared at people who are theologically trained and who read. There are very few pictures, maybe one picture in the whole document. Anybody who's visual, or who learns in another way from the linear logical, they can't relate to the documents. Most people in the world are not left brain dominant. The majority of the world is not that way, what we're finding. If we really want the content of those documents to be used, we would also put them out in drama, perhaps, in a game. We might have a simulation game so that the young can use it. We might put it out in a song so that those who can't read, you know, could sing it. We might put it out in Braille for the blind, or cassette. you know, and so on. You get the picture. We basically use our resources for those who already have a lot, but we don't realize it. I once asked the Standing Committee of Church and Society to line up along the wall a young man who is reading and has a stack of books and is reading and is obviously very engrossed in what he's reading. Next to him, a young woman with small children. And next to her, an Indian on the street. And next to the Indian, a young black street dude. And next to him, a migrant farm worker. And next to him, or her, whatever, the different kinds, a person who is handicapped, a person who is old, a person who is extremely young, and so on, just go on. And then take all of the documents that we produce in church and society and go to that line and see which ones of them will take the pile. You know, Roger. The first one might be very interested, but the rest of them can't relate to it. And so for me, an inclusive church would also put it out in a way that different kinds of people in the church, already in the church, you know, could use it. That the congregation could use it. Right there, you know, that it would come alive, that you would get it in a new song. It could be sung on Sunday morning. You know, that it would come out in a new game, you know, non-competitive game, and the concepts that we are trying to share with one another would be done in a different sort of way. Anyway, you get the picture. So then the products are designed for inclusiveness for everyone. The staff, of course, would be inclusive and so on. Now, I went, there's another linear thing that I could do, but I'm going to read to you a fantasy. It's only the beginning of a fantasy, okay? It's only the beginning. But I staff the Task Force on Racial Inclusiveness for the American Lutheran Church, and it's 10 people, a male and a female from 5 racial ethnic groups, Indians, Blacks, Hispanics, Whites, and Asians. It's a very exciting group. They have said, we understand the diagnosis. In fact, we are very good diagnosticians of the problem. We know what racism is, we know what sexism is, etc., etc. We choose to go on to the healing. We choose not to focus on the problem. And if you've been with James and I in these sessions, you will have gotten a glimpse of the power of our attention. What we pay attention to gets energy. If we pay attention to racism and sexism all the time, if we pay attention to our problems all the time, guess what? They get bigger. Because our attention is extraordinarily powerful. If we learn to shift our attention to the goal, away from the problem and to the goal without forgetting the diagnosis, but rather intentionally moving to the other direction. And that's what the task force has done. So the task force has to give a report to the Standing Committee on Church and Society, and it may go to the National Convention, and the report may sound something like this. This is like an initial draft. They haven't even seen it. I mean, they just saw it. So, I mean, there's been no feedback at all. So please understand, this is not at all official. This is like a dream. And the reason they chose this particular direction is, this is what they're saying. The Task Force on Racial Inclusiveness is in no position to preach to anyone about perfect inclusiveness, as its own unskilled behavior can testify, because they've had a lot of strains and stresses in the small group. But they choose to deal with that and to still try to learn. Community is built on this sort of stress and strain. Okay. Significantly adding to the diagnostic work already done on racism would be difficult in the time allotted. Simply restating positions against racism would be redundant. Preaching love of all races would be too vague. Proposing specific cures for racism would be too limiting. Asking for legislation for attitude on behavior changes would be alienating. Outlining all the ills of racism might actually increase the problem by giving it additional attention. And guilting is inappropriate and doesn't work effectively anyway. So they chose what has not been done, to describe a hypothetical church that is truly whole, relaxed in its inclusiveness, and exciting to the imagination. Understanding the Power of Metaphor and Images as Demonstrated in the Bible, the Task Force on Racial Inclusiveness chose these vehicles as vehicles to address the church. And here it is. So just go into a fantasy world for a minute. Visions of an inclusive church. This is the year 2020 AD. And the new inclusive church has been operational for 5 years. Church members are now very comfortable that the church is healthy and capable of addressing issues that confront it very well. A 5-year report is issued, describing what is going on at the different levels of the church. That report follows. The national structure, which is about all that has been written so far. The national structure of the inclusive church is small in comparison to the regional structure, but it is staffed by highly skilled multicultural individuals. The president of the church is a Norwegian female. The vice president is a German male, and the secretary is an Indian male. 4 out of the 9 national units have directors who are people of color. 1/2 of the unit directors are women. Support staff members and executives are evenly balanced for race and gender. Positions are flexible and shaped around the skills of staff, as well as around tasks to be accomplished. The line between executive and support staff is hazy. Individuals cross it back and forth as their needs and the needs of the church change. Salary differences between men, women, support, and executive staff are based on quality of service and the importance of the work. Some support staff make more salary than some executive staff members due to the nature and the quality of their work. Status differences between whites and people of color are indiscernible. Life skills are as valued and as well compensated as schooling skills. There are some new activities in the National Church. There is an entire unit dedicated to ecology, conservation, and stewardship of the earth. This unit has more American Indian staff members than any other unit in the church. Exciting camp activities, liturgies, dramas, and music are produced by this unit. The unit also coordinates creative education and legislative advocacy efforts to ensure the preservation of the land and the rights of rural peoples. Another unit is entirely dedicated to promoting and maintaining working cross-cultural relationships in the church. This unit produces effective reconciliation processes, educational cross-cultural experiences and job opportunities, training learning programs, new multicultural visions, stories, poetry, and celebrations. This unit also coordinates advocacy efforts for such issues as bilingual enrichment for all students, including whites. This unit has the greatest concentration of Puerto Ricans, though it has a good mix of all groups. Puerto Ricans are generally recognized as naturals in cross-cultural community building, since they embody at least 3 racial groups and historically have acted as bridges for several others. Another unit is dedicated entirely to quality of life issues. It helped in the campaign for a guaranteed annual income for all qualified residents of the country. Once the unit communicated how much cheaper and more respectful the guaranteed annual income was, it was easy to obtain endorsement from the church to work for its passage. The guaranteed income has basically abolished hunger, and the church now works toward the continual improvement of the quality of life of members and of the community. The unit collects and disseminates promising ideas for quality housing, transportation, communication, nutrition, education, and it monitors public efforts. One unit is entirely dedicated to process issues. It incorporates all former functions of interpretation as well, but it goes on to address all forms of expression. The church came to understand that process for the excluded was a justice issue and designed a structure to ensure justice in this area. This unit has a small staff, but a large pool of consultants both nationally and internationally. These are skilled in such areas as the arts, languages, braille, sign languages, etc. When another unit designs a new program, this process unit aids in the interpretation and the shaping of it. It is put out in at least 5 forms, and I gave you some of those. In the written theological linear form for the traditional older pastors and trained laypersons, in drama for those who do not read and prefer to learn through physical activity, in stories and cartoons for families with young children, in a simulation game for the youth, in music and poetry for the artistically inclined, and so on. Each of the channels reaches different kinds of people, but each one also allows members to view the issue from many sides, helping to bring it home Each form is careful to require the active participation of members or whoever is involved. For example, in the music and poetry form, participants hear a song and a poem and then are asked to respond in some artistic form themselves. This they share with one another. After several years of this kind of work, the laity responds with profound insights, and the original music and poetry is often replaced by pieces that come from the church itself. The original work is designed only to stimulate, not to confine the church. All work is considered incomplete and in process and open to improvement or correction. National staff have come to expect and welcome suggested changes as signs of high interest. The basis for all that the new church does is the biblical message of love. And that's an incomplete dream, but it's a beginning.
The BD legislates social change by documenting something like that. And trying to put that in the archives. Trying to put it for the dance and everything else.
Life is bigger than the archives.
On the way out, we stayed at a church in Nebraska, and the bishop there has consciously or unconsciously already started something you talked about. 2 weeks after Synod Convention, they had available for use of the congregation's slide and sound tape report of the convention, which is much easier, and I would listen to that. Even though I'd gone to convention and get the body of reports, I never seemed to get around to finishing the whole thing. But I would sure listen to a slideshow that somebody tells me what happened. So there are things that can be done easily.
You know, what I see as a, excuse me.
It only doesn't work when two do it at once.
One of the real strengths of this kind of approach is the discipline that it forces onto the framers of it. If I must explain an obscure theological concept in written, in drama, in dance, in music, I'm going to understand it pretty well by the time I get done.
That's right. And you won't be an elitist by the time you finish. You have a lot of respect for it.
I have one suggestion, though. I don't think you ought to send the written report to the person who reads. I think you ought to give him the drama.
That's good.
Probably nothing that we, as Americans, love more than our money. And I suspect the first difficulties that we would run into would be the financial aspects of this, and the guaranteed minimum wage or family income, whatever you want to call it, and the Christian work ethic, I guess we've come to know is, how do we work through that problem? I can just see all these guys having a lot of trouble with that. The idea of sharing as being a Christian thing as opposed to earning, you know, and status and climbing the success ladder.
It's definitely a different way of thinking.
Talking about church staff, staff of the church?
Or I don't know. I'm talking about probably more an individual congregation. The people who tend to be members of the church boards are college educated, if not affluent, at least surely not anywhere near poverty. You know, people who have reached a certain status in their life, and as part of their success story is the fact that they've gone from salesman to general sales manager to, and they want to inflict, if you will, that type of thinking upon the church too. An example, we just had a Jane will be familiar with this, the daycare. So, in our church, just started a daycare a couple of years ago. And the board, the guys, the idea of handing the power over to women and to bring in the spirit of daycare as opposed to the mechanics and their financial, really tough for a lot of those guys. And they're the guys that are basically in charge most of the time.
An area I didn't hear addressed to your group that hits me in inclusiveness is with the boards and the national headquarters, lay and clergy balance. I heard that missing.
Good for you. Thank you. Because I know that they deal with that a lot, so it's got to be in there. Thank you.
I guess that means we can only have one because it's proportional.
The ministry of the laity.
Well, priesthood of all three.
I heard something absolutely delightful that just, if you're interested in that subject, I heard Marge Wold speak, and she was speaking to someone about Africa, you know, and she'd asked someone that when she was in high school, she had been told that Africa was going to go Muslim. There was no question about it, and yet that hasn't happened. And she said, you know, what happened? Oh, she was talking to Jim Berquist from the ALC, and she said, she asked him, you know, what happened? You know, what did the seminaries do something unusual? You know, and he said, no, it had nothing to do with seminaries. It was when the people, you know, decided that they were Christians and they were going to get the message out that the whole place went crazy. You know, and we have all these African Christians, you know, growing by the day. So
that's really the only way you can be inclusive, to make that kind of fantasy.
That's right.
Any kind of reality.
You can see the imperfections in this one, because I was just thinking the laity.
No, that's okay.
There's lots of stuff that has to.
One of the things that will really be sticky that you did address somewhat is this idea of compensation for those in the employ of the church. And there's really two things that have worked that are cross purposes. One is an inclusive church you would think would be very distributed in power and distributed in process and very little concentration. Also then deciding what the pay should be for those who are in the employ of the church would be that way too. That's sort of, in some sense, the way it is today with congregations pretty much themselves deciding what the pay for pastors should be, for example, in the LCA. And that works across purposes with those who need the most, have the most trouble then getting the resources or the people with the talent that are needed there. And so going back to a strong central body that almost essentially dictates pay for at all levels in the whole new church is one way of fixing that. That's sort of not what I like either. So I have a dilemma.
I think it's a wonderful dilemma to figure out how to do just compensation, though. I'd rather figure that one out than.
But even that one's not going to be easy.
No.
You said pay according to the quality of their work.
Mm.
But that's a judgment to call.
Yeah, right now what we have is supervisors judging supervisees, right? Well, we don't have the reverse going on. Actually, it does go on, but it's informal. You know, it's behind the supervisor's back is what happens. But if there were kind of a group thing, you know, where people basically decided and helped make decisions that were just for the whole group, you know, it's a very different way of functioning that is envisioned here. And it may not be the right one, but it's a new question, you know.
I have a question about something you said at the very beginning, moving from equal representation to shared airtime, and how does that happen? I was just noticing that our group here is a good example of that. We have a very, you know, pretty mixed group as far as males and females, and we even have a female leader, but everyone in the forum that's spoken so far is a male. So how do we have shared airtime here? Should all the men just be quiet for a while? I've been in groups where it's been a big complaint that the men do all the talking, and then the men stop talking, and then there's no talking. How do we make that transition?
Are you asking me?
I'm asking anybody.
I have a thought about that.
But talking about.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it does. But do you want me to say?
Please.
Yeah. I've done a lot of work with migrant farm workers. My favorite work is with very you know, like illiterate adults, very, very quiet, very retiring, especially in the face of someone who's light-skinned. Anyone who's had any schooling, and they can tell just like that, you know. You come into a group like that, and they have a problem of some sort, and we would, in the Liberation Center that I founded some years ago, we would come in, and we'd sit down, and we wouldn't say anything. And then there'd be this very long silence. And finally someone would say, well, what are you going to do? And so we'd say, well, what are you thinking about? What's that? What's wrong? You know, what's going on? And they would have to then explain the problem. And then we would ask more questions of the others, you know, well, does anyone else have an insight into this? And we would keep a ratio of, in the beginning group of 80-20, those of us who were schooled, of 20% time, air time, and 80% until they got the idea that this was their group. And then we could shift it to 60-40. We could have, you know, a little bit more of air time. But if we're really interested in the women participating, it would be very good simply to have silence until they speak, until they realize you really mean it. As a Cuban, I'm very speedy. You know, we Cubans, especially of the schooled class, you know, we're very, very quick tongued, you know. And one of the things I learned with farm workers was that I gave them a message. If I said, what is the problem? You know, what is it that you're thinking about? And then I waited only a couple of seconds and then asked another question, that I was giving a very strong message that I didn't really want to hear the answer. So I started off by asking, you know, what are you thinking about? And I would count inside my head, one, two, and I just simply continue counting just to see how long it would take for them to get the idea that I was really waiting. You know, it really, and it was a discipline for me at first. But I think women, because the society, because of the way, the speedy male, the energy that runs it, women will tend to be much more quiet. But if they see that there really is space, there will be a beauty, a beautiful outpouring.
An alternative is that it resonates, I saw in Robert Rules and Order, as being the one way of conducting business. Other ways are all more time consuming, it seems, but that you may have, in order to get inclusiveness, have to come to that. I don't know which tape it is. I remember listening to one of John Tran's tapes where he's talking about someone else in one of the monastic orders, where they said everything was done by consensus, which meant everybody had to be heard from. And that just takes an awful lot of time. And asking how they could do that, well, they said once they had to fast for 28 days. But you have to be, I mean, you eventually, if you insist on consensus, so that everybody has been heard from and somehow buys in, that's a very time-consuming process. I can't imagine a synod meeting where every decision had to be reached in that way. Maybe we have to change the format so that everything is done in smaller groups, so you get consensus of consensus or something, but it would be a, yeah.
Yeah. There's an interesting thing that happens in process and in the human brain. When you slow down, you actually speed up. There's like an inverse reaction. Our fear is that if everyone is involved and pattern thinking goes on, that it's going to slow it down. In reality, it speeds it up. But we don't have a lot of experience with real process, with real inclusive process. And so our fear is that it isn't going to go at that. What happens, I think, really is true in linear processes. Things are done very quickly, but they're done very shallowly. There's very little profound connection of the people with whatever decision it is.
What do you mean when you say process? Can you talk about that a little bit? Way out of community that.
It's the way we do it.
I was here at the village the first year, John, and Mary were directors. I spent, my wife and I spent a year here, 16 months here. And we did operate by consensus, and it did take a long time, and it was frustrating. But it certainly changed a lot of lives too, and nobody felt, as far as I can see, left out. You, when the majority rules, no matter what the majority is, someone is always left out. And more often than not, it's the quiet person sitting in the back of the room.
But there's also the way the brain operates. If you get everybody's input, you know, you have this myriad amount of information, and we think, because of the way we've been trained, that too much information is not good for us. The opposite is true. The brain doesn't even activate until it gets a really good problem that it has to put a pattern into, you know? So what they suggest is that we increase input by 10 times, but we do it multi-channel. You know, we do it in multiple ways, and then the brain activates and puts a pattern and gets a profound, that quiet person in the corner, gets a profound answer.
And many times, one person changed the whole community. More often than you would think.
I've got a question. For your story, your ideal of the what the church is, how would you turn your story? Well, how would you?
Visions of an inclusive church.
Visions of an inclusive church. Do you see that as the goal, kind of your personal goal, as what the church should look forward to?
I see it as a piece of, I see it as a pattern that I can see now that would be better than what I'm living now. It will change, because it isn't now, and I wouldn't ever want to legislate it. Mm-hmm. But it's like, it's a way of raising a new question for myself, and I can then organize around it and test out, would this really work? Is this really what I would want? Would this really work for an Indian? Would this really work for white people working with black people? Would this, you know, and so on. So it's not like, it's some of the best thoughts I've had. That's the only thing.
Well, when it's a description and the answer instead of a rehash of the problem. I think that's the best feature of that.
You like that?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. You know what I like about it? To go back to that? There's no bad guys in this. There's nobody is the, you know, the ogre. It's like we're all winners, and that's nice to dream like that.
I guess I would like to say I like that vision that you have there. I see though that if that was you, that there would be a lot of people who would say, but how do we get to that vision? And they continually say, well, I'm sorry, we have to have suggestions. And I like the approach of saying, okay, this is the good, this is what we would like to have, now let's just come and do it. But I see where there's a lot of conflicts of people who are saying, how do we get to that?
I would like to hear June lay out her vision of it too, because I see the answer to your question in the combination of the vision.
That's right.
I have a hard time knowing how what you've laid out would work in a complex organization. But with June's model of regional centers, what you're talking about makes perfect sense.
Would it make sense?
No, I wouldn't mind. I just wanted to soak up the richness of your perspective. You know, I'm on a commission of 70, and last week we had a forum on the new church. But the inclusive church, I mean, while they're parallel, and yeah, I'd be happy to share that, I didn't want to focus on the new church, because it seems to me that the inclusive church comes really from your experience and background in the now and your vision of where we're going. But I'd be happy doing that we spent time under the tree. It was kind of astonishing. The rapport and energy between the two of us, having never met before, finding a lot of the same kind of process and thinking and vision and imaging that has been going on independently, and yet is part of a pool of resource. Basically, the concept, and these are on reserve because I did this last week, and I had many people come up afterwards saying, where can we get a copy of this conversion? We really look at this more thoroughly. So Larry made about 12 copies, and they're in here in the library on reserve. The basic concept is that language is power, and as you're saying, we image toward futures. And it does have a real impact on where we end up by where we begin. And the way we name ourselves is very significant. There is a different image in the concept of headquarters near a lot of people. Reflecting on, well, where will the headquarters of the new church be? And who do you think the archbishop will be? And how are we going to organize the division? I mean, it kills me. Just think about that. We're talking about the new church in terms of division. You know, which in itself is a descriptive word of how we think of our relationship. It's very different to talk about centers of light. It's a very different thing, isn't it? Talk about renewal center or centers for light, as opposed to talking about synod office or district headquarters, which are very much kind of another kind of relational sense. On the commission, there are some who really appeal to the episcopal image, the episcopacy, the sense of the apostolic tradition, the handing down, the good order, the preservation of doctrine, the sense that authority should be placed in the hands of those who are the educated, those who have the doctors, the theology, who are in the teaching staff, who are the ones in which we have deposited all knowledge and the right to take hold. I mean, hear that? I've heard that on the commission. You know, the ALC was very strong at their convention, that they wanted theologians on that commission. They wanted people who were authorities in the area of the doctrine of the church, the history of the church, that ultimately this should be placed in their hands. Okay? When you get into the commission, you have 70 people that have been elected and given authority to do this. So a Spensby or a Price or a Crumley will have to take their seat.
I love it.
They got no more access to that floor than I've got. And I'm just a woman. In other words, they must, of course, be included. And their expertise, their insights, their training, of course, cannot be ignored. But it is not the only dominant authority in that room. Those who are new in the church, it's like the story of the vineyard, you know. People get real mad about that. These birds come in the 11th hour and they expect the same page. And they're Chicanos, for heaven's sake. Now, what are they doing in this vineyard? How do they show up in this commission? What do they know? They're right off the street. They aren't even using the right jargon. They're talking about love. I mean, that's ridiculous. That love would have any place in a high-powered commission that's putting together the nuts and bolts of a massive 6 million member structure. Where do we look for the authority? What is the voice here that images for a new minister? Don't talk about the merged church. It's not a merger. It's a new thing. It's the best of each of the three becoming more. Is the way we'd rather look at. Well, the model here is one that looks toward the very kind of thing that you have been putting before. And that is a center for life, where you have a holistic concept. I made a little diagram here. You know, the Indians had what they called the kiva. Those of you in the West, are you familiar with the Indian kiva? Which was really the ceremonial kit. Can you imagine Lutherans having a kiva?
Why not?
But the concept is very same. Saying that we are grounded in word and sacrament. We say that we are at the spiritual well. We say that we are called to model what it is to be human in a very materialistic, dehumanizing kind of culture. We talk about the Word made flesh, active, alive in the midst of us. We talk about celebration. The only way we can have credibility is if we stop talking about it and enact it in a lived out dynamic where you have got your lay academy, your crisis resolution, your liturgical renewal, your global mission, your media resource and research library, your pastoral congregational care, in your seminary education, all around the kiva, all around the kiva, so that they are informing one another, they are interacting with one another, they are sending and receiving with clusters of congregations that are in the area of the renewal center. I don't know how many of these we would need, but then in order that we might have the national Petrine voice. And we do need the Petrine voice. You know what I mean by that? The voice of authority that speaks for the church. That these centers for life, and by the way, you know, a name for the church, and I shouldn't say that, because it's really premature. That's another one everybody's saying, what are you going to call it? What are you going to, you know, it's a big. If we're going to have centers for life, then maybe we should be the Lord of Life Church. In an age that looks toward darkness and toward death. And maybe we should use contemporary technology. For example, if you watch the McNeil Lear Report, you ever watch the public television? You know? Okay. They have a wide screen where they have someone sitting here, maybe someone here, and then maybe McNeil is over there in Washington with somebody else. There's immediate communication via the transmission. Okay. There's no reason that I could think of that you couldn't have these networks in instant communication nationally with that kind of a hookup. There is no reason why the clusters of congregations could not have extension of education through cable, but through other means, where you could have lay education and clergy education going on, as well as having teams of poets, clowns, theater people, liturgical dancers, available to go out to the clusters from the Center of Renewal to do training, to be in residence, to work in celebration, to have large liturgical gatherings, like for example one, the Cadet community in southern France. Are you aware of that after the Second World War? Whole peace movements that rose. There are thousands from from around the globe that gather in this big community for one thing, and that's to pray, for celebration, for liturgy. There are no reasons why these centers for life cannot be wells for renewal. There's no sense having LCA headquarters on Madison Avenue, publication in Minneapolis and Philadelphia, lay training. I'm in lay training. Lou's in lay training in the sense we're campus pastors working with the formation of leadership in the church, both with faculty and students. Seminary education dispersed. There is no reason why we should not put these functions of the body in juxtaposition in communication, centered in word and sacrament, as empowerment for the laity and the clergy. And more than that, as beacons to the world, that the world might believe. With multi-channel ways for that message to permeate. Your national Petrine voice then would come out of your centers for life, who would also use the kiva, the ceremonial kit, for the open forum, for deliberation, and for the election of the National Coordinating Council, who then would be reflective of all of these centers of life in terms of enunciating policy and direction internationally, nationally, and so on. Each center regionally would deal with particular problems, and this may vary. It may be in Appalachia, you're looking at the landscape. It may be in Detroit, you're looking at displacement of workers. It may be in Milwaukee, we're closing another brewery. I mean, Dole, you know. I was going to sit here and do my citrusy, and I wasn't going to get into this habit because I really wanted to focus on a lot of that neat stuff she's been sharing. But this, I'm only touched on this, but it's only four pages. And there are copies in here in the library, and they're accessible to you. And I wish you'd read it and reflect on it and open your imagination to alternatives. We don't have to do it the way we've always done it. We don't have to have a national headquarters and an archbishop and a, you know, this kind of hierarchical process. We can have holding villages all over the country.
Right on.
And we can be alive and vibrant, and we can be the church. I mean, it's possible. You're not that far out, sweetheart.
Thank you.
The beautiful thing is that we don't have to reinvent the wheel, because the Quakers have already done a great deal of this. There's not just Robert's Rules of Order versus consensus. There are infinite numbers of varieties of consensus to decision-making. A number of us use, you know, 10 or 12 of these different isolated models. But there's lots of stuff that's gone on, and the Quakers are the people who have broken through on this stuff. Years and years ago, the Movement for a New Society ought to become the consulting body for the new church, because they're the folks who've had it together, they've got it in writing. It's all in fact.
That is right on. That is right on. I have not seen it in congregations, but I know it exists out there. If there are lots of alternatives, there's the effective meeting process. There's just many of them that work much better for everybody.
At the risk of speaking too much, Ada and I had positions of responsibility in Lutheran Emerging Town for District 5, which includes the whole Northwest, including Alaska and Western Canada and so on. And we presided over the transition from Robert's Rules of Order to consensus. And it can be done, but it is extraordinarily difficult to take some of us old unreconstructed Germans and say you can't vote. And we had people that were acutely uncomfortable with that. But, you know, you talked about it being faster. I'm not sure that we found the decision process faster.
but we sure found the implementation process a whole lot better.
Okay.
A vote divides, it sets up 70-30, and the 30% always carries that defeat with them.
So they worked against the other 70.
Yeah. And even if they're, you know, people of goodwill,
yeah,
they still have that underlying difficulty. But all I'm saying, for those of you that haven't tried it, take heart, it can be done, we saw it work. It really works.
Another problem I see, speaking of conventions, and it kind of starts from the bottom up, is that the people who vote, whether it be a national convention or a state convention or whatever, are the people who have access to either vacation time or their own. Mm-hmm. The people tend to be higher educated. I don't know what percentage they are of the whole church, but probably a minority. People who are their own bosses, self-employed, whatever. And there's a lot of those, I don't want to offend anybody, because I'm in the group, I guess, common people who, for whatever reason, don't even have access to the voting process because of those types of things. I don't know how you address that problem, but I see a lot of people out there who are alienated in that respect.
Mm-hmm. One thing that you might want, that might give you some more heart, is there are a lot of studies out, and Hazel Henderson reports on them in her book, Creating Alternative Futures, you may have read about, that people in structures are basically between 5 and 10 years ahead of their own structure. So the people in the Lutheran Church right now, in the churches, are at least 5 to 10 years ahead of the structures they have. You know, so don't look to the structures for leadership. We have to look to the people for leadership. They're out there at the cutting edge. They are creating new ways. Unfortunately, I see the inverse happening.
I keep wondering how I'm going to convince Ed Larson of that.
Who's Ed Larson?
He's in our congregation. He's still out of the Red Book.
We have some of those in our
very important in our
yeah, that I think is a very important point. Yeah. You know.